I recognize that in the last couple of years, as I've been up here on stage from time to time, I've alluded to the fact that as a family, my immediate family, this recent season of life has been a difficult one for us. More specifically, I guess I would say that the last three and a half years have been the most challenging we've ever walked through by a long shot, and experienced things we never thought we'd have to experience in life. And while I know some of you wish I was a little bit more detailed about what all that entails, I also recognize it's one thing for me to tell of my experience. It's another thing for me to hold in trust the stories of those who are closest to me. And I intend to honor and love them by offering them safety and the right to tell their stories if and when and where they would choose to tell them. Now, life together is one of our values as a church, and I think that value pushes us towards authenticity in our faith community as much as possible. And while I don't believe that authenticity is about every one of us having to tell the whole world every detail of our lives, which would actually be unhelpful and probably would be destructive to some point, I do think, in our context, it means finding those people within our faith community with whom we are willing to share deeply and invite to be on the journey with us. And at the same time, I think it's about being able to be as real as possible at a higher level with all of us together as a church family. And that's why I try to, as best I can, simply acknowledge to you, as my whole church family who I love, that life has had significant challenges in the last bit. It's been painful. I don't want to pretend with you that that's not the case. In the midst of the brokenness we've experienced these last few years, though, God has been faithful in meeting us and meeting me along the road in a variety of ways, helping us move forward and getting us to the place, even today, where, by His grace, I can say we're a fair ways past our lowest moments. In part, God has accomplished some of that healing through deeply valued and trusted people in this church community, and I'm so grateful to those of you who have journeyed deeply with us. For me personally, another helpful part along the journey was a book that I believe God brought across my desk that was helpful to me in sort of navigating a season in which I couldn't make heads or tails of what God was up to in life. And it very simply reminded me that biblical faith is not first and foremost defined as right belief, but rather deep trust. God wasn't asking me to cognitively work out everything He was up to in my life. He was asking me to hang on to Him, even when I couldn't make sense of the storm. It was a helpful reminder for me. And then last fall, I was on a development leave, a good chunk of which was focused on my ongoing education. But as class wrapped up, I found myself with the better part of a month to be more intentional about some spiritual self-care. And that brought me to the book of Job. Now, I know some of you might be inclined to read something uplifting to help pull you out of sorrow and grief. And Job is not that. But what I really needed was to sit in my brokenness and acknowledge it, lament it, come to grips with it, and maybe find some healing from it. So Job was my source book for lament. I read through it slowly that month, chapter by chapter, and at the same time was reading John Goldengay's commentary on Job as I went along. In addition to being a brilliant theologian who I deeply admire and respect, John also lost his first wife after 40 years of watching her struggle with MS. And I really appreciated the way John's reflections and his commentaries were both a mix of deep theology and real personal experience with suffering. So here's Job in a nutshell. Job was a rich, respected, godly man who in the course of one day gets an avalanche of terribly bad news. First, word reaches him that his oxen and his donkeys have all been stolen by raiders, and all the servants working with them have been killed. They've been murdered. No sooner has that news reached his ears that another servant comes with more news, that his sheep and his shepherds have been consumed by fire from heaven. And then comes news that another group of raiders have stolen Job's camels, and the servants watching over them have also been all murdered. It finally comes news that his kids were all having a party together, and a strong wind came along and knocked down the house they were in, and they have all died. That's not a good day. And as if that wasn't enough to deal with, Job is then afflicted with sores from head to toe. Many translations call them something like loathsome sores. The Hebrew word there is the word for evil or wickedness. This is not a minor skin rash, folks. These are terrible sores. And Job sits in ashes, sits in emotional pain, scraping his skin with a broken potsherd. Your favor, O Lord, made me as secure as a mountain. Then you turned away from me, and I was shattered. That verse wasn't just some theoretical idea for Job. This was his life. See, what Job doesn't know, though, is that the reason all this is happening is that there's a bit of a heavenly wager going on. There's this being that the text simply calls the adversary, who approaches God one day to argue that the only reason Job is such a good guy is because God has been so good to Job. God thinks there's actually more to it than that. So the deal is that the adversary can do anything to Job that he wants, anything short of killing him. And that test would see whether God or the adversary was right about what kind of person Job was. Now, last week I talked about the frustration of going through a hard or unfair season of life and not have God tell us the why, not give us the reason behind our suffering. But when I read the story of Job, I have second thoughts about that frustration. Job never finds out the why right to the end of the story, and I'm thinking that might be a good thing. Because if he knew that he went through all that he went through because God and the adversary were running a little test, I'm not sure he would have found that very comforting. I don't think I would have handled that explanation very well. Maybe knowing the why of our hard circumstances sometimes is worse than not knowing. Well, onto the scene come three of Job's friends. They've heard his plight, and they're coming to be with him. And as they approach him, the text says this. It says, when they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him. And they raised their voices and wept, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads towards heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. Job is the one who finally breaks the silence and begins to lament his terrible situation. And then Job's friends, who had been doing so well up to this point, decide to open their mouths. They have all sorts of helpful advice to give, all sorts of perspective to offer, and it is totally unhelpful. They would have done far better if they had just sat there with him in silence. Those of us who walk alongside people who are going through deep waters maybe should take note of this. Sometimes our presence is more valuable than our words. And if we do want to speak into the suffering of others, we need to recognize the power of our words to have comfort and the power of our words to hurt more deeply. For about 28 chapters, in fact, Job and his friends go back and forth, and it's clear that the words that his friends are speaking this whole time are hurting Job, not helping him. Well, once they give up, we find out there's actually another guy who's been hanging out, listening in, a young man, who's been taking in the proceedings, named Elihu. Elihu then finally talks, but he doesn't engage in dialogue with Job. He gives a 6-chapter monologue to Job, which is equally as unhelpful as anything his friends have said. And then God speaks to Job, nearly uninterrupted for 4 chapters. When I got to this part of the book, in my slow reading of it last December, I must have read that block of 4 chapters over and over again every day for a week. I just sat in them. If you haven't read Job for a while, chapters 38 to 41, they almost read like a creation narrative. God is recounting to Job his role as sovereign creator, setting up and running the entire cosmos. It gives this sense of the bigness and the awesomeness of who God is. Where Job, and frankly probably where I, was asking God the question, God, what is all this pain about? God doesn't answer in the way one might hope he'd answer. Here's what he says to Job, a little snippet of it. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? Or on what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? There's four chapters of that. It seemed that Job needed to be reminded, I needed to be reminded, that God is God and we are not. God moved Job towards grasping more deeply that relationship that exists between the Creator and His creation. Yes, God is imminent. God is closer than our breath. But He's also transcendent. God is far above our understanding. See, God isn't anti-rational, but God is trans-rational. His fullness is beyond your rational capability. Job needed to recapture the truth that a God who can be comfortably captured in our minds is no God at all. And that also means that sometimes how that God operates is also beyond our ability to understand. Well, halfway through God's speech, which is essentially, you know, asking Job lots of questions that underscore how big Job is and how big God is and how little Job is, Job jumps in, and I think he's trying to end the conversation by his response. He says, "Behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I've spoken once. I will not answer twice, but I will proceed no further." Essentially, it's a bit like saying, "I'm going to shut up now, God. Can we just pretend none of this ever happened?" To which God responds, "I'm not done, Job. And you're not going anywhere. I am asking you questions, and you will answer my questions." And he goes on for two more chapters. Same line of questioning. And then Job responds again. But this time, his answer seems more satisfactory to God, because God quits asking questions after this response. Job basically plays out a conversation with God, maybe to make sure that he does respond to God's questions this time. So he says this. He says, "I know you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted." And then he asks the question God has asked. He puts it in God's mouth. "Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge?" And Job answers, "Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand. Things too wonderful for me, which I did not know." Again, God's words. "Hear and I will speak. I will question you and you will declare to me." And Job's answer is, I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." Reminds me of a verse from Ecclesiastes that says, "Be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. For God is in heaven, and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few." See, Job has been wrestling with his pain and his loss, wrestling with his friends who are trying to pin the blame on him for what's going on, wrestling with God and making the case that he's pretty sure he doesn't deserve any of what's happened to him. And at the end of the day, God's response to Job basically boils down to, "I'm God, you're not." And strangely, as basic as that thought may be, when Job, after much wrestling, actually gets it, when the penny drops, it is enough. It is enough. Gaining perspective on his place in the universe, and God's too, somehow works for Job and helps him find a measure of peace in the midst of his pain and suffering. And then there's this fascinating bit in the story. I mean, we usually like to jump right to the end then, to the part where like everything turns out really well for Job. But something else happens first. The text says this. The Lord said to Eliphaz, the Temanite, "My anger burns against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Now, therefore, take 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and offer up a burnt offering for yourselves. And my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept his prayer not to deal with you according to your folly. For you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has." So Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Namathite went and did what the Lord had told them. And the Lord accepted Job's prayer. Now think for a moment about the context in which God tells Job's friends that the only way they're going to escape divine punishment that God intends to level on them is if they go to Job and have him pray for them. Now remember, at this point in the story, Job's fortunes haven't changed. Nothing about his circumstances have improved. He is still in emotional and physical pain. He still doesn't know why he's suffering. He's been failed by his friends who don't know how to lament with him. They've actually made things worse. He's just finished getting a lecture from God and being put in his place soundly. And now, the fate of his friends are put in his hands. If he decides not to pray for them, presumably, they will be punished. They will receive the natural consequences for their wrong actions. On the flip side, Job can choose the way of obedience and grace. He could choose, in his pain, to bless and pray for his friends who have caused him pain, and in doing so, release them. His choice will decide. And, you know, I think we likewise often have to wrestle with what kind of choices we're going to make when we're walking through pain and brokenness. Especially what kind of choices will we make towards those around us? Will we lash out? Will we take out our pain on others by treating them poorly? Do we act as though, you know, if I'm not happy, no one should be happy? Do we become self-absorbed? You know, shouldn't everyone be paying attention to me? Isn't my pain the biggest thing in this world? And then specifically when it comes to the people who may have contributed to our grief and our pain, I mean, what happens in our hearts towards them? Do we want them to suffer the way they've made us suffer? When our lives go sideways, are we sometimes more inclined to want to inflict something on them that they've inflicted on us? Do we want to act out in a way that actually causes more hurt and pain and brokenness in the world around us? Why should we be the only ones? Or can we still choose to be people of grace? And even in our pain, be a blessing to others. Even those who seem way better off than us. Even those who misunderstand us. Even those who have forgotten us. Even those who have caused our pain. Last fall, I took a class with our own Rob Hebert, a class on Genesis. He introduced us to a Terrence Malick film called The Tree of Life. It's a very artistic kind of film, not everyone's cup of tea by any stretch. But for me, it was profoundly meaningful and moving. The movie essentially is about a family that experiences deep, significant pain as the result of a personal tragedy. And it's actually set very explicitly against the backdrop of Job, and that comes through a number of ways through the movie. One of the places that comes through, and I'll sit and just watch this scene, there's a scene that takes place shortly after the movie makes us aware of what the cause of pain in the movie is. And then seemingly out of nowhere, The movie shifts to this extended scene that shows the universe being formed. It's this grand cosmic scene that gives a sense of the bigness and the vastness of God, the universe unfolding before our eyes on the screen. And as it does, you hear the voice of this mother who is in deep grief and pain, whispering to God, "Did you know? Who are we to you? Answer me. We cry to you. Hear us." Something about this mother wrestling with God, one person living on a tiny planet, set against images of the entire cosmos coming into being, felt like a Job and God conversation. It felt like a Matt and God conversation. The movie actually opens with a text from Job 38, part of God's speech to Job. And then as it gets going, there's a voiceover that happens, a little narration that I actually have printed and sits in my office. It's a reminder to me of the kind of person that I want to be as I walk through life. The voiceover says this: "The nuns taught us that there are two ways through life, the way of nature and the way of grace. You have to choose which one you'll follow. Grace doesn't try to please itself, accepts being slighted, forgotten, disliked, accepts insults and injuries. Nature only wants to please itself, gets others to please it too, likes to lord it over them, to have its own way. It finds reasons to be unhappy when all the world is shining around it. And love is smiling through all things." See, no matter how difficult life can be at times, there's always a choice to make. Will I choose the way of nature, a way that puts me first, makes my pain the thing that matters the most, makes my happiness more important than the happiness of others, expects other people to see me and notice me and give way to me? Or will I choose the way of grace? The road of not retaliating against those who harm me. The road of treating others not as they deserve by their actions, but graciously, because they're valued by God. The road that recognizes that just because I have needs doesn't mean I don't have value to offer other people, even people who might be ungrateful for it. Now, I know for sure I don't always get this right, but the way of grace is the way of God. And it's the road I am intent to travel, whether on the mountaintop of life or drowning under the raging sea. Job had to choose the way of nature. He could ignore the friends who had wronged him. He could say, "I'm not praying for you," and just let them experience the consequences of their actions. Or he could choose the way of grace. That though they had hurt him, he would set them free. He would not let them receive what they deserved. Job chooses the way of grace. He prays for his friends. The friends who have failed him, he prays for them, and he releases them. He gives them their freedom. He gives them life back. Does it seem counterintuitive? Absolutely. It would be nice to think that your friends would pray for you when you're going through a Job situation. But in the story, they don't pray for him. They've done little more than tell him that they think God is angry with him. And now, in a great reversal, God definitely is angry with them. And it's Job's prayers that are the only thing that will save them from God's anger. It's Job's prayers that will pour grace into their lives. And I think it turns out that Job's gracious response isn't just good for Job's friends. I think it's good for Job too. His decision to choose grace, I think, is freeing for him. John Golden Gay writes that having Job have to make the choice to act gracefully towards his friends would also ensure that Job cannot hold on to any justified resentment at the way they've let him down. Resolving issues in life is often incomplete if we only resolve issues between us and God, we also have to make sure that relationships with other people are restored. And there's nothing like praying for someone to make sure your attitude to the person is in order. Thus, there turns out to be a link between Job's willingness to pray for his friends and the restoration of Job's own life, which only follows after the prayer. It's in keeping with this idea that Jesus says that we will be forgiven only if we forgive others and not otherwise. Well, Job's story turns out well in the end. Kind of. I mean, let's be honest, getting your lucrative livelihood back doesn't somehow erase the trauma you have gone through with losing it all in a day. And while having more children at the end was certainly a blessing for Job, the new children don't replace children who have died and certainly don't take away the pain every time their birthday comes around and you don't get to celebrate. But it is interesting that it's not until Job chooses the road of grace against all odds that life moves a new direction. And maybe there's something to that. Of course, it's not a hard and fast rule of life by any stretch of the imagination. There are those who choose grace, and God doesn't remove their suffering, and that's a fact too. But the outcome doesn't change the fact that the choice Job made to walk the road of grace was the right choice, because it's the choice that looks most like Jesus. As we bring this series to a conclusion today, let me just give you a couple final words. I think we need to be real, church, about the fact that life often doesn't go the way we'd planned. And for some people, those challenges are overwhelming. For some people, those experiences are shattering. For those of us who don't walk in that season of life, we need to make space for those who do. We need to honor their pain and discover how we can do life with them in a way that is helpful and not hurtful. See, Job's friends' mistake wasn't that they came to be with him. It's that instead of simply sitting with him and grieving with him, they tried to fix him. I know that sometimes we get scared off from those who are in pain because for those of us who maybe haven't walked that road, we don't know what to do with that. We don't know how to do with those people. Like, how do we respond? I get that. I hear that. Can I encourage you? Just be brave. Be courageous. And just simply choose. I will walk towards those in pain, not away from them. And if you feel ill-equipped to know what to do, my advice to you is simply is this. It's really simple. Just show up. Just show up. Your presence often communicates far more than your words ever could communicate. Just show up. For those who are here today and are walking deeply the road of suffering, I want to remind you, and the reason we've done this series in large part is to make sure you're clear. God welcomes and invites your lament. He invites you to be gut-wrenchingly real with him. And know that being broken doesn't mean God is done with you or that your purpose in life is somehow on hold. God reminds us, no, you can do well even as you navigate your pain. God invites us to be people who dispense grace even as we feel wrecked. I can't prove this empirically, but I would say that experiencing grace from a person who is themselves broken, there is something of the depth and quality of that grace that I think those of us who are doing well just can't touch. There's something about that. You can do well. You can still dispense grace. You can do well in your pain as you walk towards God. And it's that towards God that I want to underscore. Walk with him. Keep running to him. Bring your questions to him. Bring your pain to him. Come to him with your big feelings. Don't check it at the door. God loves you more than you can know. And though he may not answer all your questions, though you may not like all his answers, or maybe sometimes all you get from him is a reminder that he is God and you're not, he is a loving and compassionate God who walks with you in your journey. So in the brokenness of your today, or the brokenness that you will one day inevitably experience, may you know the goodness and grace of your Father in heaven as he walks with you amidst the shattered pieces of life. So God, thank you that you promise never to leave us or forsake us. Thank you that you see us, that you know us, that you attend to us. These words appear over and over and over in Scripture. You are not a God who watches from afar. And so for all my brothers and sisters in this room here today, whatever they walk through, whether it's joys that they're celebrating or pains that they're experiencing, may they know that you are there celebrating with them and crying with them. God, in all things, might we be those who, in good and bad, we run to you. We always move your direction, knowing that you welcome us, for which we are eternally grateful.